Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. The coronavirus pandemic threw a curveball at parents across Illinois this year. As schools and child care centers began to close in March and April, parents were suddenly forced to juggle their work, Zoom school, and 24/7 child care. With kids at home and more household responsibilities, working mothers in particular have had to reduce their job hours or walk away altogether. That is, if they didn't lose their jobs because of the pandemic. Today, we're looking at the disproportionate economic toll the pandemic has had on women, the effects of reduced child care options on employment, and the long-term implications of women's job losses during the pandemic. Joining us for this conversation is Julie Cashin, director of the Women's Economic Justice at the Century Foundation. Hello, Julie. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. The number to call is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455, especially if you are a working mother. How have you been affected by virtual schooling, by reduced child care options? How are you holding up? Join the conversation. Give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also always tweet us at 21st Show. So, Julie, before we begin talking about the effects of reduced child care options on women's employment, can you tell us how and why women have had it harder than men in terms of job losses from this pandemic?
Yes. A New York Times article by Patricia Cohen called it a 1-2-3 punch, where, you know, first the service sector that has more women in it was most affected because restaurants and retail were closing down because of the pandemic. Then we saw job losses in the public sector, which is also a sector dominated by women. And then the third punch is the child care and school closures that you mentioned. And I'd actually add that they then got a kick, which is the kick is the, you know, women were also on the front lines as essential workers, and especially women of color who are, you know, the home care workers, the nurses, the healthcare workers, the doctors who are, you know, risking their own health and their family's health in this moment. So this whole pandemic and the recession and the government's responses and lack thereof have really impacted women a lot.
How does that compare with the last big recession, the Great Recession in 2008, in terms of job losses?
Yeah, the Great Recession, many people called it a he-session or a man-session, whereas this one they're calling a she-session. And in both that recession and in previous, men were the ones who were more impacted. The sectors that men tend to dominate, like construction and manufacturing, were much more impacted the last time. But because of the nature of this recession and how we've had to react to the public health danger, the service sector and other sectors that women dominate have been much more impacted this time.
We asked our texting group, Text the 21st, about this topic. Hannah in Champaign wrote in to say, I am homeschooling my two kids, working as a graphic designer remotely, part-time, and taking a class at Parkland. That's the local community college. She goes on to say, it's been tough, and I really feel like I'm drowning. I also suffer from ADHD, and it has been long night after long night. It's a struggle. We both have to work, but it's usually me that takes care of the kids. It just happened that way since I quit teaching. I wonder if you can talk about specifically the experience of a part-time working mother and how that might differ from a full-time working mother or a single mother.
Well, I think this is a story that we are hearing all over the country in every single community. And part of it is coming out of the fact that we have never built a care system. We've relied on the unpaid and underpaid work of women and mothers and women of color, Black and Latina and immigrant women to solve these problems. And so when the pandemic hit, women were already, you know, running a marathon and juggling, and now they're doing the same thing while juggling fire. So it's just gotten, you know, or maybe even running backwards, right? It's just gotten so much harder. And so for part-time work, you know, some women were already working part-time. Many have had to reduce their hours in order to take on many of the care responsibilities. And what that means for them is that they may, you know, have lower wages as a result. They may not have benefits anymore as a result of that. And they're saving less for retirement. So, And a lot of times, in conversations with people who work part-time, they actually often work full-time hours and just get paid part-time. And so I think that, it's a struggle whether you're working full-time, whether you're working part-time, whether you lost your job, because even those who are working full-time right now, are maybe getting a call, the school closed down for 2 weeks because of a quarantine need, right? Or you have to keep your kids at home. So we don't have any reliable system underlying all of this to keep women afloat right now. And it is the women who are doing the majority of the caregiving.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Julie Cashin, Director of Women's Economic Justice at the Century Foundation. And we're talking about the disproportionate economic toll the COVID-19 pandemic is having on women and what the long-term implications of that are. And we do want to hear from you out there. The number to call, 800-222-9455, especially if you are a working mother who has been affected by virtual schooling or closure of childcare centers. 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And I want to bring another guest in now. Rachel Dekus is an administrator at the Siebel Center for Design at the University of Illinois. After the switch to online learning, she shifted to homeschooling her 9-year-old daughter. Rachel, thank you for coming on the show today. Welcome to The 21st. And can you talk about why you made that decision to go with homeschooling?
Yeah, thanks, Brian, for having me. It didn't come as an easy decision or a light one. And I have to say, my husband and I did not have homeschooling a third grader on our pandemic radar, if you will, even in the spring. But I think that with so much that was being discussed in terms of, were the students going to be face-to-face? Were they going to be virtual? And a lot of those conversations were happening. The very complex, the various approvals that different school districts, at least in the state of Illinois, had to get approved at the state level. It kept pushing back those decisions. And then it just by default ended up having a really sudden and immediate impact on working families to figure out how are they going to juggle everything. My husband is a critical care nurse at Carl. He works weekends and on Mondays, and I work, kind of a traditional Monday through Friday schedule. So we've been able to stagger our work lives fairly successfully with some hiccups along the way, just naturally. But I think the biggest thing for us is that we saw an opportunity with our 9-year-old to be a bit more hands-on with her learning. The virtual Zoom learning I know this from my previous role at the School of Social Work, that is not for everyone. And just sitting in on her sessions, seeing the teacher and all of the students like trying their best, we thought we think that we can handle this for now and try to provide her with a different kind of learning experience. So it wasn't necessarily a fault on what the system was doing, what the school system was doing, or what her individual teacher was doing. It was more of we're in a position to try to add this as a additional way of trying to problem solve and troubleshoot. I think another thing that was really a huge factor and a big consideration for us is that with my husband working at Carl and being exposed to COVID every time he does work, we just knew that we're a small family that might have this like strong likelihood of being potentially contagious or asymptomatic. And if and when school was to go back to face-to-face, like while he's still working in a healthcare system, we just know that adds just additional layers of complication for both us and for others that are going to be interacting with us and our daughter.
How has your work life been? Has taking on this homeschooling responsibility affected your ability to do your job?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think even before there was a pandemic, there is a hidden labor and a constant mental load that is on working parents. And I would, I'm biased when I say this as a working mom. I think it's, some of that mental load is probably, statistically has been proven to be much heavier on working women or individuals who identify as female. I think that, for me, I miss that ability to walk across campus and have just some like physical and mental space to just either decompress from one thing and kind of like prep my head for the next thing. In a virtual work life, everything for me has just been back to back to back. And, you know, even Outlook just, you know, defaults as like 1 hour. And so I've had to be much more intentional with blocking out time, either in the early morning or closer to the afternoons or different times throughout the day where I can just be like literally like physically and mentally and emotionally present for myself, but also for my family and for my daughter. You know, Mondays are definitely, Mondays and Fridays are really like the hardest struggle for us, just as a little immediate family, because on Mondays I have to be the primary parent. And so I'm trying to do some work. I'm trying to be like very much like present and hands-on with my daughter. And then just also like helping to like run interference on that tag teaming like throughout the week. And then especially on Fridays as we're getting ready for knowing that that Steve will be working like throughout the weekend and on and again on those Mondays.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like a lot. Sounds like a lot. I want to read another listener text now. Ricardo in Urbana wrote, "In speaking with a Champaign immigrant woman, she shared two related complications. Her husband was laid off for over 3 months, which left her as the sole income and the only maid at one of the local hotels, COVID-19 all around her. She cried and cried, but went to work and took all precautions she could. She came to get vegetables at the pantry for her and neighbors that really needed it, but could not leave the children alone." Julie, I want to ask, can you talk about the particular limitations and risks that this pandemic is posing for low-income working mothers?
Yes, it's making a very challenging situation that existed before the pandemic, where many families were not able to find good affordable childcare in their homes and were having to, or good affordable childcare in their communities and having to kind of make do with piecemeal approaches. And, you know, now those piecemeal approaches aren't even there, right? If you were relying on grandma before, now you might not want to because, you know, older people are more at risk for getting COVID and having worse impacts from it. And so the, you know, the choices that did exist before this are even more limited now. And those choices were never great to begin with. There was a recent article that said something like the United States doesn't have a safety net, it has women. And I would say that, you know, low-income women and a lot of women in communities of color are really taking the brunt of it, where they're, you know, struggling to continue to bring in a paycheck. They're trying to keep their family safe and healthy and them safe and healthy and make sure that their children are cared for. A lot of families, you know, the older child is having to step in and become the caregiver for the younger children, and that's impacting their school, right? And so it's just having ripple effects that are impacting their ability to have financial security, and not to mention the extreme amount of stress. You know, Rachel talked about just, you know, in her family where they are working and they're making it work, but there's so much stress to kind of juggling all of these different pieces.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned communities of color in there too, because in preparing for this, we read that almost a third of Black women work in service jobs compared to a fifth of white women, and they are more likely to have lost their jobs throughout this pandemic. Can you talk about Black and brown mothers' experiences with loss of childcare and how that differs from the experiences of white women?
Before the pandemic even, women of color and mothers of color were often had more job disruption than other women did because of caregiving needs and because of the lack of a childcare structure and a childcare system. And so now things are even worse because they're both, you know, more likely to be in these jobs that are going away and you know, being forced out of the labor force, but also not able to get the care that they need. You know, and really, like, this is about sexist and racist choices that our country has made over time to not invest in a care infrastructure that we need, to not pay for care jobs, you know, what they're worth, and even a history that, you know, kind of pushed Black women into specific types of jobs over time and, you know, the cultural norms around that. And so this is another opportunity for us to kind of wake up to that and say, we can do it differently, right? That we can build back better than before and build a care infrastructure that values the work of, you know, Black women and immigrant women, and values care as something that should be paid much better and that should be available to everyone who needs it.
I hear what you did there with the Build Back Better, moving the Biden campaign slogan from infrastructure into other sectors of the economy that probably need that just as much, if not more so. I'm going to reintroduce you. We need to take a break here. We're speaking with Julie Cashin, who is Director for Women's Economic Justice at the Century Foundation. Also, Rachel Dekus, who works at the Siebel Center at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and has also taken on homeschooling this year in the pandemic. Listeners, we do want to hear from you. 800-222-9455 is the number. Especially if you are a working mother, if you have a break between Zoom meetings, homeschooling, whatever else, all the other things that people are taking on these days, give us a call. 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to continue this conversation after the break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking this hour about women's economic circumstances and the COVID-19 pandemic, the effects of reduced childcare options, unemployment, the long-term implications of women's job losses during the pandemic on economic prospects. Joining us for this conversation is Julie Cashin, Director of Women's Economic Justice at the Century Foundation. We're also speaking with Rachel Dekus, who is a working mother who has also taken on homeschooling this year. And I want to introduce Cheryl Forrest Morganson into the conversation. She's a freelancer working to earn her Doctor of Musical Arts in vocal coaching while raising a three-year-old. Cheryl, thank you for coming on The 21st today. And can you talk about how the inaccessibility, the difficulty in finding childcare this year in particular, has affected your academic studies?
Oh, yes. The one little bit that is potentially unique to my family is that in summer of 2019, my daughter had a history of respiratory failures. So my husband and I have already seen our daughter on oxygen and struggling to breathe, and we got past it as a family, and I'm incredibly grateful to Carl and Christie Clinic for getting her through that. And then February of this year, you start to hear about this respiratory infection that has people struggling to breathe and laboring in the hospital. And I don't mean to make light of PTSD since I have it, but it kind of hit me right in the PTSD. So I was doing the last little bit of my doctoral work, and I was teaching a course, and everything shut down. As I'm sure all your listeners know, the arts have been hugely impacted by the COVID pandemic. Absent the ability to have audiences, we are making art, and I'm so happy with my colleagues that are making art. But I will freely admit, given the topic of this conversation, that I don't see too many of my colleagues who are parents doing the same joyful virtual events as my colleagues who are child free.
Yeah, no. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm sorry, and I'm glad that you've gotten through the health difficulties with your daughter last year. How has the pandemic? I mean, I'm guessing. I don't know if you had recitals you still had to do or things like that. I mean, all that gets put on hold, right?
Yeah, I'm chuckling because yes, it is. Recitals in a safe recitals in a COVID era are a thing that we are all still figuring out.
Not singing is one of the things you're not supposed to do to prevent
and that,
transmission.
As a collaborative pianist, my recital, I can't have a karaoke track going with me. I'm supposed to be in a room with somebody. And I freely admit we're all figuring out what our risk level is. But my risk level as someone who's in her 40s with a child with a history of lung issues, I'm not willing to do a recital and accelerate my graduation time by 6 months or a year if it puts my daughter's life at risk, if it puts my own life at risk. And that was, I think someone had said, both, you know, not an easy choice to make, but a necessary one. And we've been trying to deal with the ramifications of that. Obviously, as a musician, I went from 65 public performances last year to basically nothing this year. So I now identify, you know, what I do day in and day out is I care for my three-year-old. Anyone who has a three-year-old know that is a 24/7 prospect. Like you turn your back and suddenly they have knives and fireworks and you're just like, where did this come from? And so that is what I do. And when I've tried to work, because as a musician, I sit down at the piano and I try to play, my beautiful daughter, who I adore, comes over and wants to play with me. So it's even this idea of, oh, I could work early or I could work late. If I'm playing the piano, Clara wants to be with mama. And I, as a parent, that makes my heart melt. But as a professional, it was so frustrating by early spring. I just said, okay, I'm just going to step back from music as much as I can until there is an end in sight. And then I will start thinking about being a musician, because trying to be both mother and musician in my situation, it was just, I was failing at everything.
Yeah, there's no break room, no sick days for parents. Rachel, everybody's circumstances are unique, obviously, but I'm wondering if anything that Cheryl had to say resonates with you about children and interfering with Zoom meetings and other things that people are doing these days.
Oh yeah, I mean, I can definitely both empathize and sympathize. And I chuckled while I was on mute, just thinking about the days of when my 9-year-old was a 3-year-old. You know, three and four were much harder years. And I think about like what would this be like if I were a single parent, if I were a woman of color, if I didn't have a job, if I, my little family, we have many like earned and unearned privileges and benefits right now. Just being in a position to be able to say that let's embark on this adventure of trying to do homeschool for third grade is, we're trying to make it fun for all of us, although it's a lot harder in some ways than having her in maybe structured public school. I just think that, I keep hearing these themes based off of, things that Cheryl has said, questions that you've asked, Brian, and the keen insight of what Julie has shared. I mean, these systems have been designed to not be terribly supportive. And I think we could probably, I think anyone who is maybe listening or who has, you may listen later on, was there even a system to begin with that was actually really like foolproof and supportive before a pandemic? I mean, the thing about the pandemic is that it has shown all of the cracks in all of these systems that were designed to not work well. And, how can we redesign them for the future? I mean, it's something that we think about redesigning and human-centeredness all the time at Siebel Center for Design. And if we do not take advantage of this opportunity to do things differently, it'll be a whole other kind of pandemic and massive failure on all of our parts.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. That is Rachel Dekus, who is a working mother, also taking on homeschooling of her 9-year-old daughter this year. We're also speaking with Cheryl Forrest Morganson, who's working to earn a Doctor of Musical Arts in vocal coaching and finding that not a lot of vocalization going on this year, especially for working parents, given the pandemic. We're also joined by Julie Cashin, Director for Women's Economic Justice at the Century Foundation. Listeners, we do want to hear from you. 800-222-9455 is the number to call, especially working mothers, if you have the time. 800-222-9455. Julie, I want to ask, sort of take a step back here. When women leave their jobs, how does that affect, voluntarily or involuntarily, as the circumstances may be, or sort of have their hands forced this year because of the situation with all the schools and the pandemic? How does that affect their ability to secure employment again? And then beyond that, affect lifetime earnings?
The leaving a job right now, or even reducing hours right now, has a major impact both today on the ability to pay your bills and on tomorrow. And so there's no given that when you leave a job or lose a job, that you're going to be able to get back into the labor force where you were before. And especially if this recession continues, it's going to take a while before we have the jobs available for people to get back into. So there's sort of this risk of longer term unemployment that could be really challenging and painful, and especially as unemployment benefits and extended benefits are running out, you know, without congressional action, that's going to be a major issue. It also impacts retirement security. If you, you know, no longer have someone paying in for your security, or if you're no longer working and having your earnings go to Social Security. So you have kind of this immediate impact, you have this longer term impact. And then it doesn't just impact women and our families, but it also impacts the larger economy and our communities. And this report that I wrote with Sarah Jane Glynn from the Center for American Progress and Amanda Novello, my colleague at the Century Foundation, we found that the aggregate effect of mothers potentially leaving the workforce right now could be a loss of $64.5 billion per year for the economy. And so that's like, that's a huge number. It's hard to get your head around, but it's sort of the equivalent of losing an entire state of economic activity, like losing West Virginia's economic activity. So we need to worry about this for individual women, but it's really has ripple effects for the entire economy. And if we keep doing this kind of DIY, the do-it-yourself approach where every family is for themselves, we're, you know, we're all going to be worse off for that.
You know, yeah, and you mentioned the economic productivity numbers, and of course, parental labor is one of the huge things that is not counted in GDP when you think of our economies. Is anyone doing anything innovative about this? I think of like National Guards people, right? If someone's called up, they're sent overseas, deployed for a while, the employer kind of has to put a bookmark on that job for the person, in at least in some states. I think that's pretty sure that's the case in Illinois. Is anyone talking about, you know, sort of a pandemic service exception job bookmarks or anything along those lines? What do you have any reasons for optimism? Is somebody doing things right at this time,
say,
or are we just,
you know,
all like scrambling?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, on one hand, we are all scrambling. On the other hand, Congress did pass emergency paid leave, and there are parents who've been able to take paid leave from their jobs where, you know, they're not losing their paycheck, and they're able to go back. And they were able to do that because their schools were closed or their childcare was closed or because a family member was sick. Now that is actually going to expire also at the end of the year, along with the unemployment benefits. And so we need to both extend that and also expand it, because the White House ended up making a lot of holes in that policy that only about half the people who should have been able to get it were actually able to get it. So paid leave, paid family and medical leave, paid sick days are both really important, and sort of, you know, it's, they're not necessarily an innovation the way that you're saying, but they are in that we don't have a national paid leave system. And so it would be innovative for us to not only have this emergency system, but to actually enact a permanent paid family and medical leave and paid sick days programs where, you know, you could actually just rely on being able to take time away from work to care for your family and put your family first without worrying about your paycheck or your job. So I would say let's innovate around these ideas that exist already, as well as putting in, you know, Congress has actually passed more than $50 billion for stabilizing the childcare system, but the Senate has not acted on that. And so, you know, there are these ideas on the table from a policy perspective that if we could move them forward, if Congress would move them forward, things could really change for families and for the sector.
Cheryl, I wonder, as you listen to this aspect of this conversation, what is there something that you would like to see the government doing that, you know, would make your life easier, your situation improved?
In general, I wish we were not so beholden to people having to come in sick. And this is perhaps this is a very broad thing. Yes, I think we should have universal childcare. I think there, you know, any politician who dares say, oh, I'm pro-family, and doesn't have a plan for actually helping us out, particularly, and again, I think others have said, I'm speaking as a white woman. I have a roof over my head and food on my table because my husband can work from home. Others who are in much more dire straits than me. But I just, we have this idea in America that it's brave and noble to go to work sick. And I think it's horrible. Like, it's, you know, I think it's, before this, we've had losses of productivity of parents deciding, you know, do you have to, can you send your kid in to sick? Is it just the sniffles? Is it something worse? And then COVID has made it like I think one of the previous commentators has said, COVID has exposed all of the cracks in our system. So for me, if we could have policies that allowed people when they were sick to stay home, that allowed parents to not miss paycheck, that allowed kids to be cared for, I think that would be my dream.
Yeah. Rachel, how about you? Is there anything from a policy perspective that you would want to see coming out of this pandemic?
Well, I guess if I speak to the very spirit of the work that I do as a social worker and a designer at Siebel Center for Design and really fully embracing those elements of human-centered design and human-centeredness, it would be to actually include the very people who are impacted by these systems in the redesign of the new ones. And so, I mean, I don't know where that is explicitly happening. I'm sure there are small pockets of innovation where that is occurring, but for that to be happening on a broader, either statewide or national policy level would have a tremendous impact on how we do things differently in the future.
Julie, we're almost out of time. We've only got about two and a half minutes left in our conversation here. But in preparing for this segment, we did also come across a paper that suggested, this was from some economists, including a couple at Northwestern University in Illinois, that despite the generally gloomy outlook for women in the pandemic from an economic standpoint, that maybe there could be some changes that have the potential to reduce gender inequality in the labor market in the long term. One of those is this idea that employers are seeing the need for childcare with their employees more visibly, literally on Zoom calls sometimes, and are adopting more flexible schedules and telework options. I wonder if you think that there is a chance of that becoming persistent and possibly affecting workplace policies in the long run.
I do think that the fact that this moment has shone a light on just how broken things are is also an opportunity to not only change policy, but also cultural norms for, you know, women like Rachel and Cheryl to see, you know, it's not just you, it's all of us, right? It's, you know, this is not an individual problem for us each to solve. This is a public problem and it has public solutions. And I think we are seeing that more than ever. So I am hopeful that that means we will build the care systems we need, that we will enact the paid sick days and paid family and medical leave policies that we need, and that we'll stop relying on mothers to be the safety net and start to actually build a support system that works for all of our communities.
And we're going to leave the conversation there. I want to thank my guests. They've been Julie Cashin, who is the Director for Women's Economic Justice at the Century Foundation. Rachel Dekus is Associate Director of Programs at the Siebel Center at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And Cheryl Forrest Morganson is a freelancer working on a Doctor of Musical Arts in Vocal Coaching. Julie, Rachel, Cheryl, thank you all so much for sharing your expertise, experience, and stories with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the 21st, today is Illinois' birthday. It's Statehood Day. 202 years ago, Illinois became the 21st state. We're going to have a conversation with Laurent Pernault. He's an author who has a new book called There and Here, Small Illinois Towns with Big Names. That's coming up after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us.